The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the June 19th, 2026 issue of the Week. I have been out of town for a couple of weeks and glad to be back with you with a new issue of the week. The cover drawing is looks like the Democratic donkey. Riding on his back is Graham Plattner. He's in jeans and no shirt and a hat, and he's got a fist raised. But the donkey has just bags all over it, and it's weighed down and obviously stressed. They seem to be walking a trail on the main coast. The headline is Plattner's baggage. With his ugly history, will his ugly history cost Democrats the Senate? That is our first main story. We will start with that. Scandal hit Plattner sails to primary win in Maine. What happened? Graham Plattner, a Maine oysterman whose populist Senate campaign has been dogged by scandal, handily won the state's Democratic primary this week, setting up a face-off with Republican incumbent Susan Collins that could determine control of the Senate. A win was all but assured for Plattner, a political novice whose chief opponent, Maine Governor Janet Mills, left the race in April, citing Plattner's fundraising edge. A Marine combat veteran, Plattner galvanized Maine Democrats with calls for universal health care and a message that the deck is stacked against working people. But he also attracted national attention for a string of revelations that surprised the party establishment, including that he had a chest tattoo resembling a Nazi symbol. He has since had it covered up, derided police as bastards and rural Americans as racist and stupid on social media, and sexted with multiple women after marrying his wife in 2023. In a New York Times story published last week, several former girlfriends said they found his behavior disturbing. Lindsay Fifield, a GOP activist who dated Plattner from 2013 to 2015, said he once twisted her arm behind her back and locked her in a bedroom. Plattner, who acknowledges having acted badly while struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder after four tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, called the allegation false and politically motivated. The mounting scandals raised questions about whether voters would stay home or vote in large numbers for Mills, who remained on the ballot. But turnout was strong across the state, with Plattner pulling 72% and Mills 19%. "It is my job to earn your trust," Plattner told a room of cheering supporters on primary night. "If you believe, as I do, that we can change our politics and change our country, then you must also believe that people can change. And the reason I believe that is because I have lived it." Plattner now faces Collins, a five-term GOP moderate, in a race considered crucial to Democrats' hopes for winning a Senate majority in November. Collins, 73, called the allegations against Plattner extremely troubling. The Republican National Committee called him a sick and deranged person. Plattner ally Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, said Democratic voters want candidates who will challenge a broken status quo, and that taking on the billionaire and donor class matters far more than imperfections in their own personal life. What the columnist said: "It's hard to know what's worse," said National Review in an editorial, "Plattner's pattern of deception or the willful credulity of his supporters. Take his preposterous claim that he didn't know until October that the skull and crossbones tattoo he got in 2007 was associated with the Nazi SS. Fifield said he taught her the German word for it years earlier, calling the tattoo my Totenkopf. Then there's his attempts to portray himself as a working-class oyster farmer, despite having a wealthy upbringing, and attending an elite boarding school. His excuse for past missteps is that he went through a rough period after his military service and emerged a better man. But the sexting happened as recently as 2024, and he had an active profile on Kick, a chat app favored by teens with a reputation as a predator's paradise. Warts and all, Democrats must rally behind Plattner, said Joan Vannacci in the Boston Globe. Personal morality matters up to a point, but the standard can't be to never make a mistake. Those of us appalled by a corrupt administration that tramples the Constitution are looking for another kind of morality. What matters here is not a tattoo or sexting scandal, but what is moral for society. That's a slippery slope, said Kevin D. Williamson in the Dispatch, and the same one Republicans slid down with Donald Trump. They acknowledged his many flaws, the affairs, the corruption, the hostility to democracy, but argued Democrats were so wretched and dangerous that they must be overlooked. Democrats have rightly condemned Trump and the moral tar pit in which he long ago sank the Republican Party, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. But those same Democrats are now quick to dismiss woman's troubling allegations against Plattner. Instead of displaying rank hypocrisy, they should denounce Plattner and show that some things are more important than a relentless quest for power. In backing an untested and scandal-plagued oysterman, Democrats are taking an enormous gamble, said Lisa Lehrer in the New York Times. Plattner now must pivot from being a left-wing insurgent to winning over centrist Mainers as Republicans unleash a flood of advertising hammering his character. But Collins also faces considerable challenges. She's yoked to an unpopular president and must persuade voters eager for generational change that she remains fit for a sixth term at 73. One poll taken before the latest Plattner revelations broke showed him leading Collins 51-42%. Still, Collins is a political survivor who's defied repeated attempts to oust her, said Sahil Kapoor in NBCNews.com. In 2020, Democrats were brimming with optimism about flipping her seat. She won by more than 8 points, even as Trump lost Maine by 9. Maine voters now face an uneasy choice, said Christina Cotterici in Slate. The energy around Plattner makes clear that many Americans are sick of scripted establishment candidates, and Plattner is anything but. But will Mainers go all in on an untested outsider with more than a few red flags and enough jagged edges to crack a lobster shell? With 5 months left before November, there's ample time for Plattner to soothe any misgivings and re-up his promise to fight for the Maine working class. But there's also plenty of time for more damaging stories to drown out that message. And we'll read the second Maine story. U.S.-Iran ceasefire falters as war heats up. What happened? The war between the U.S. and Iran appeared to reignite this week after the two countries exchanged the most intense strikes of the two-month ceasefire, and President Trump warned Tehran would pay the price for taking too long to negotiate a deal. The flare-up began after an Iranian drone downed a U.S. Apache helicopter near the blockaded Strait of Hormuz, where the two crew members were recovered safely in the first U.S. military rescue operation using an unmanned sea drone. The U.S. responded with strikes on Iranian air defense systems, ground control stations, and radar sites. Iran then retaliated by launching ballistic missiles and drones at U.S. military bases in Bahrain, Kuwait, and Jordan. Officials said nearly all were intercepted. The ceasefire has been in jeopardy almost since it was announced on April 7th, with Trump alternating between saying a peace deal was imminent and threatening renewed attacks. This week, he said he was considering bombing Iranian bridges and power plants, a threat Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian called a sign of desperation in the face of a nation's will. Iran and Israel also resumed fire this week, in direct defiance of Trump's demands. Iran had largely stayed out of the conflict between its Lebanese proxy, Hezbollah, and Israel. But when Israel expanded its attacks on Hezbollah from southern Lebanon to Beirut, Iran struck back. Trump said he'd ordered Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to retaliate against the Iranian strikes, telling the Financial Times, "I call all the shots. He doesn't call the shots." Israel, however, launched dozens of ballistic missiles at Iran just hours later. What the columnist said. Trump's war has only emboldened Iran, said Daniel R. DePetris in MS.Now. When he launched the war in February, he believed what Netanyahu had told him, that the Iranian regime would crumble or give up. 4 months on, Iran is led by an even more extreme regime and is launching new missile salvos. Iran isn't just holding its own militarily. It's arguably more aggressive today than before the U.S. bombing campaign began. That's exactly why Trump shouldn't be trying to restrain Israel, said Aaron McLean in the Free Press. Hezbollah continues to lob rockets into Israel, and now Iran is launching missiles on Hezbollah's behalf, tying Israel's hands, as Trump seeks to do, simultaneously protects Hezbollah and complicates the broader U.S.-Iran peace negotiations. Already, Trump has abandoned his original war aims, which included constraining Iran's missile program and ending its support for terror proxies. Now he wants to stop Israel from achieving its main aim. In fact, before the latest exchange of strikes, said David E. Sanger in the New York Times, peace negotiations were on track, and we had reached the hazy outlines of an accord. The new nuclear deal would include four major points: a 15-year suspension of Iranian uranium enrichment, the dilution of Iran's enriched uranium stockpile, the dismantling of all three major Iranian nuclear sites, and a mechanism for snap UN inspections of those sites. If Iran eventually agrees to those limits, it will be a significant advance over the 2015 Obama-era deal that Trump tore up. That's a huge if, said Mike Nelson in the Dispatch. Far more likely is that Trump will reach a settlement that's favorable to Iran. Remember his disastrous agreement with the Taliban in 2020? He was so desperate for a deal, he agreed to release thousands of imprisoned Taliban fighters and withdraw U.S. troops from the country, setting up the botched withdrawal under the Biden administration the following year. Trump's eagerness to end the war means he has ceded control of the narrative to Iran, said Edward Luce in the Financial Times. Just like Jimmy Carter, whose presidency was hijacked by the Iran hostage crisis in 1979. Trump may loudly insist he's calling the shots, but there's now a near universal impression that he is unable to control Netanyahu, and that could be fatal to his prospects of ending the war. Why should Iran do America's bidding if its own ally won't? Once the idea forms that a U.S. president is prisoner to what others decide, the scent of impotence is hard to shake. Our controversy of the week, media, a plot to murder 60 Minutes. In this dark moment, Scott Pelley is the hero we need, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. At an all-hands meeting last week with Nick Bilton, new executive producer of 60 Minutes, the veteran CBS correspondent demanded Bilton explain the previous week's Black Thursday massacre, in which correspondents Sharon Alfonsi and Cecilia Vega were fired along with other senior staff. When Bilton claimed ignorance, Pelley took him to the woodshed. He accused Bilton and Barry Weiss, the Free Press founder now running CBS News, of trying to murder 60 Minutes as a favor to President Trump, who has a long-standing grudge against the show. Not coincidentally, CBS's billionaire owners, Larry and David Ellison, need Trump's approval to complete their takeover of Warner Brothers Discovery, home of CNN and the Warner Movie Studio. Bilton swiftly fired Pelley, but failed to silence him. Speaking later to the New York Times, Pelley debunked Weiss' ludicrous rationalizations about revamping 60 Minutes for the digital age. Viewership climbed 9% last season, and online views 190%. More damning, Pelley claimed that in February, Weiss pushed him to impart a Trumpian spin on a report on anti-ICE protests in Minneapolis, demanding he make the demonstrators look more violent and inform viewers falsely that protester Renee Good was driving toward the ICE officer who shot her dead. "I'm sorry," said Charles C.W. Cook in National Review, "but no employee can behave like this and expect to remain employed, even one who makes $7 million a year." Before last week's blow-up, Weiss and Bilton invited Pelley to clear the air in private. Pelley refused, preferring to humiliate Bilton before the full staff, which he did in deeply personal terms, mocking Bilton's slender credentials and sneering that he will never be welcome here. "There's something unconsciously fitting about Pelley's self-martyrdom," said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. In his hysterical reaction to Weiss' changes to 60 Minutes, the 68-year-old Pelley displayed the pomposity and unreflecting lefty self-righteousness that made those changes necessary. "Pelley's not the only one getting old," said Chris Saliza in his Substack newsletter. "The average 60 Minutes viewer is now 65. The show's audience is literally dying off, just as broadcast TV itself has entered terminal decline." Bilton tried explaining this during Pelley's barrage, likening broadcast TV to an ice cube that is melting. In a prior memo to staff, Bilton claimed to have a notebook full of ideas of how 60 Minutes can thrive in a post-broadcast world, said Brian Stelter in CNN.com, and maybe he does. But if he and Weiss bungle the execution of those ideas as badly as they've bungled the last 2 weeks, many staff fear they'll succeed only in speeding up the melting process. "Maybe 60 Minutes will survive in some form," said Rick Wilson in his Substack newsletter, "but its days as a beacon of accountability journalism effectively ended last year when Weiss tried to scrap a report on El Salvador's CICOP prison, then the Trump administration's preferred destination for migrant deportees. True, David Ellison reached out this week to staff, promising to respect the show's editorial independence. But with an autocrat in the White House, what sane billionaire wants to bankroll the work of asking questions that make powerful people uncomfortable? In our 250-year history, 60 Minutes' ticking stopwatch was the closest thing American power had to a conscience it could not buy. Until they did." Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for artisan bakeries after Italian scientists extracted yeast from the gut of Ötzi the Iceman, a 5,300-year-old alpine mummy, and used it to make bread. "Initially, it didn't work," said the lead researcher, Mohamed Saran, "but after 3 months, we had a very, very good sourdough." It was a good week for winging it after an Air Canada pilot who flew more than 900 domestic and international flights over 17 years was arrested for allegedly having forged one of the licenses required to rise to the rank of captain. Police say the unnamed pilot was arrested after a long and complex investigation they dubbed Project Icarus. It's a good week for bumblebees, who are as good at solving problems as elephants and chimps, according to a new study. Researcher Oli Lakula challenged the bees to use a foam ball as a step to reach a reward, and says his findings prove very tiny brains can solve super complex problems. But it's a bad week for enemies within. After reports that the Maryland Building Housing, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, the federal agency responsible for tracking and containing the spread of invasive pests, is infested with bedbugs. The irony of the situation, said an agency source, is lost on no one. It's a bad week for connectivity. After a study by economists at Vermont's Middlebury College found that the rollout of the Apple iPhone explained up to 52% of the drop in the U.S. fertility rate from 2007 to 2011, possibly because the device disrupted in-person interactions and boosted access to porn. Finally, it was a bad week for pep talks after the president of Taiwan's Hsin University apologized and took a two-month leave of absence following a commencement address in which he advised graduates who struggle with the demands of the workplace to quickly end themselves because this world no longer needs your existence. The title of the briefing this week is A Murder Mystery. Homicides have hit historic lows in cities across the nation. Criminologists are trying to puzzle out why. What do the statistics show? That the U.S. is experiencing the largest and most sustained drop in homicides on record. After spiking sharply at the start of the pandemic, peaking at 6.8 murders per 100,000 people in 2021, the homicide rate started to come down in 2022. Since then, murders have dropped by an average of 16% a year. They fell 21% across 35 large cities from 2024 to 2025, according to the Nonpartisan Council on Criminal Justice. Killings declined in cities in blue and red states. Chicago and Baltimore both recorded a 31% drop to 416 and 133 homicides, respectively. Salt Lake City, 27% to 8, and St. Louis, 11% to 121. If a similar decline is reflected in national data, the homicide rate will drop to 4 per 100,000, the lowest since 1900. Early figures for this year suggest the downward trend is continuing. New York City registered 102 murders from January to May, the lowest number on record for the period, and down 21% from the same months in 2025. Such numbers are absolutely astonishing, said CCJ President Adam Gilb. It's a historic collapse in the homicide rate. Other violent crimes are also down. From 2019 to 2025, the robbery rate fell 36% in major cities, carjackings 29%, and domestic violence incidents 19%. What's driving this drop? Some of it is a reversal of the pandemic effect. The factors that sent the murder rate soaring 30% in 2020, social disruption, workplace and school closures that put young men on the street, stay-home recommendations that trap people with abusers, faded as normal life returned. But murders have since dropped well below pre-pandemic levels. The Trump administration has a simple explanation. It says President Trump turned the tide by removing savage criminal illegals and flooding blue cities with federal agents. Experts give that claim no credibility, noting that murders started dipping years before Trump returned to office. Instead, it seems as though multiple factors are behind the decline, including important shifts in policing. How has policing changed? After temporarily retreating from many communities following the May 2020 killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer, which led to Black Lives Matter protest and calls to defund the police, cops got back to work, said former New York Police Department Chief Kenneth Corey. They also became much more focused on gun violence. Part of that involved zeroing in on the small number of repeat violent offenders responsible for an outsized share of crimes. Advances in DNA technology and the spread of surveillance cameras also helped catch killers. There's nowhere in the city where you can walk without being on video, said Frank Simpson, chief homicide prosecutor in Camden, New Jersey, which recorded 12 murders last year, down from 67 in 2012. But some experts question the role of law enforcement in the homicide drop, noting murders have fallen as police departments across the nation have lost manpower. Philadelphia, for example, has the fewest officers per capita in 40 years and just posted its lowest annual homicide total, 222, since 1966. What else could explain the decline? Crime experts and local leaders point to the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan Act, the ARPA, which then-President Joe Biden signed in March 2021 to combat the pandemic's impacts. It sent hundreds of billions of dollars to state and local governments, which in many locales funded community violence intervention, CVI, programs. Indianapolis Mayor Joe Hogsett credits his city's plunging murder rate in large part to Indy Peace, a CVI program that offers support to gunshot victims and their families in the hope of preventing retaliatory shootings. It saves lives, said Hogsett. The federal windfall also went to other community investments that may have made a difference. Summer jobs, programs for teens, after-school programs, community centers, and mental health services. I think it has gone unrecognized how incredibly effective it was in stabilizing communities, Princeton University sociologist Patrick Sharkey says of ARPA. Other changes in American habits could also be curbing violence. What kind of changes? A decline in drunkenness. 54% of U.S. adults now say they drink alcohol, the lowest in nearly 90 years, has likely helped shrink the number of murders. You get drunk, you do something stupid, said Rafael Mangual, a fellow at the conservative Manhattan Institute. Experts also nod to the effects of social media. Many young people now socialize online rather than in person. The way the 2022 homicide spike took potential killers off the street, and even the possible influence of GLP-1 weight loss drugs, which may diminish impulsive behaviors. But none of these factors can explain the sheer scale of the murder drop, said crime analyst and former CIA agent Jeff Asher, and neither can changes in poverty or the availability of guns. We didn't fix any of those things, Asher said. So what you're left with is a bunch of explanations, none of which explains it all. How low will the murder rate go? Experts don't know that either, and point to two factors that could nudge it back up. One is that the Biden stimulus money is running out, and its effect will wane substantially this year, said John Roman, a University of Chicago criminal justice researcher. Then there are the steep cuts to community funding by the Trump administration. As part of its offensive against DEI and cultural Marxism, it terminated at least 373 grants from the Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs last year, wiping out some $500 million in funding for efforts including CVI programs, victim services, and programs to aid ex-offenders. Some experts call that a tragic miscalculation after such historic gains. Don't take our foot off the gas, said criminal justice researcher Jennifer Doliak, we do have control over our destiny here. And we'll read a few of the best columns. Does Bolton deserve to be imprisoned? For someone who hates being the target of lawfare, said the Wall Street Journal, President Trump sure knows how to wield it. Trump's Justice Department pressured former National Security Advisor John Bolton into pleading guilty last week to retaining classified information. That's a fig leaf for his real offense, the sin of writing a critical book about Trump's first administration. The president was furious when, in 2020, Bolton published The Room Where It Happened, a well-regarded bestseller about Trump's chaotic foreign policy. In writing the book, Bolton relied on more than 1,000 pages of electronic notes he took while serving as National Security Advisor, some of which contained classified information. The government excised that classified information during pre-publication review, but Bolton was nonetheless charged with a felony for retaining the notes and threatened with years in prison, a likely de facto life sentence for a 77-year-old man. So Bolton agreed to plead guilty and pay $2.5 million, a punishing sum for a longtime public servant. And yet the vindictive Justice Department is still asking the judge to imprison Bolton for up to 5 years. That only proves that this case is purely about Trump's revenge. A devastating debt crash is coming. The ballooning national debt may be an incredibly boring topic, said Megan McArdle, but Americans need to take a hard look at the bill that is rapidly coming due. The debt currently sits at $31.6 trillion, and earlier this year surpassed 100% of gross domestic product. With annual budget deficits now reaching $2 trillion a year, this slow-moving disaster is out of control. The federal government now spends a third of all tax dollars on interest payments, more than it spends on national defense or Medicare. Democrats blame the Bush and Trump tax cuts, and Republicans rail against Democratic spending. But much of the debt stems from the bailouts and stimulus that followed the 2008 financial crisis and the COVID pandemic. Both parties have also refused to touch the highly popular entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare. There is only one way this kind of profligacy can end: a fiscal crisis that necessitates huge spending cuts and a major tax hike. Meanwhile, Americans have collectively decided not to think about it until we make landfall or whatever hellscape we're approaching. If we do nothing, a devastating crash becomes inevitable. This is an international How They See Us column, titled A World Cup of Exclusion. The World Cup is supposed to bring the planet together, said Michael Brian Lee in the Mail and Guardian from South Africa. But with Donald Trump as host, it's about keeping people out. The soccer tournament is the one global venue where former colonies defeat empires, where countries with tiny populations like Iceland and Cape Verde challenge superpowers. For a few weeks every 4 years, fans voyage across the world in a giant temporary migration to cheer on their national soccer teams in the host nation. But Trump's America, hosting jointly this year with Canada and Mexico, is in the middle of a brutal immigration crackdown, rounding up and deporting non-citizens who have lived in the U.S. for years. And it is even barring tourist entry to soccer fans. More than three dozen countries are on the banned list, including four of the 48 nations competing and half of Africa. My fiance, for example, had hoped to join me in covering the games, but but she can't get in because she's from Zimbabwe. A World Cup without global fans is not fully a World Cup. It's just TV content rather than culture. No wonder many are boycotting the U.S. portion of the game, said Mitchell Nicholas in the General Anzeiger from Germany. FIFA loves to suck up to strongmen hosts, letting them use the tournament as an image-polishing exercise for their pariah nations. It let an autocratic warmonger, Russian's Vladimir Putin, host the Cup in 2018, then allowed the monarchist, human rights-despising regime of Qatar to do the honors in 2022. So it's fitting that the host now is Trump, a plutocratic patriarch with a fascism fetish. FIFA chief Gianni Infantino has an obsequious relationship with Trump, said Dirk Hautkopf. He even awarded Trump a fake peace prize to make up for the Nobel the president coveted. And his organization has transformed the spectacle into an unprecedented money-making machine, with tickets easily surpassing $1,000 even for run-of-the-mill early matches between bottom-tier teams. What do you expect? FIFA put the World Cup in the country that hates the sea, that hates the world more than anybody, said Bruce Arthur in the Toronto Star. The Trump administration, a collection of the most rabid, venal, and dim-witted Americans available, is doing its best to make everyone feel unwelcome. It even threatened to shut down international flights to so-called sanctuary cities that resist ICE raids. That's most big American cities. Even if Trump weren't president, the U.S. is simply the wrong venue for what is, to many, a sacred event, said John Carlin and Clarin from Argentina. Americans just aren't as mad for footy as Brits like me are, or indeed as everyone else in the world is. Giving the land of Hollywood and the NFL the World Cup is like holding the great annual celebration of Islam, the Hajj, in Ibiza instead of Saudi Arabia. Still, fans will always want to see their national teams play in person, and there are two great players making their last appearance in the Cup this year: Portugal's Cristiano Ronaldo and Argentina's Lionel Messi. That's why many Argentines are prepared to sell their houses or whatever it takes to go to the U.S. Nothing is more important than Messi. And the last word, our feature article, A Lonely Fight Against Big Tech. An AI data center the size of 3,800 football fields could soon be built outside a tiny Montana town, said Juliet McCour in the New York Times. One local mother is determined to stop it. At the top of a gravel road inside a small aluminum-clad building, Cassie Solberg arrived at another town council meeting in Broadview, Montana, causing trouble. This time, the mayor threatened to call the sheriff. Solberg was at it again, demanding information about a Houston company's plan to build a behemoth 5,000-acre AI data center campus near her rural property. The development, part of a nationwide boom in facilities that can power AI, would be the size of about 3,800 football fields. Her face grew red when Broadview's mayor turned down her request to host a public forum about the data center. Because the property was outside town limits, it doesn't affect us, he said. It affects your residents, Solberg said, leaning forward in her chair, frustrated that the council members didn't share her unease that the project could destroy the area's traditions of farming and ranching that have endured for generations. One of only two members of the public at the meeting last month, she asked, has anyone on the town council signed a non-disclosure agreement with the developer that would keep them silent about the project. The mayor said the council wasn't obliged to answer the public's questions at the town meetings, according to what the town's lawyers had told him. One council member leaped from his chair to confront Solberg, demanding she leave. Another council member, the mayor's sister, said the group had no power over whether the data center would come to Broadview. "You can't stop it," she said. Still, Solberg, 43, is trying to stop it, or at least slow it down until some questions are answered. She is stepping into an increasingly common role for residents in rural communities throughout the U.S. where data centers are planned. The fledgling gadfly taking on big tech, racing against the clock to rouse concerns among neighbors over construction projects so large they have no precedent. Developers and the tech companies behind the quick and quiet proliferation of data centers often respond with little transparency, asking communities to simply trust them while sharing no official plans. "I think they count on us being dumb country people and us not pushing back," Solberg said. "But by the time you figure out what these companies are planning to do, they've got the data centers built already." The Cassie Solbergs of the country might not have the financial might, political power, or legal arsenal needed to beat back the multi-billion dollar projects catalyzed by the world's most powerful companies, but they do have a fierce loyalty to the way of life and their land. Can a stay-at-home mother of six thwart one of the biggest developments in her state's history? On one side of Solberg's 21-acre property, the jagged teeth of the snow-capped Crazy Mountains rise from the horizon. Everywhere else is an endless jigsaw of green and tan fields and farms, home to antelope deer and prairie dogs. Coyotes howl at night, but the loudest sound on most days is the wind whooshing through the grass, the white noise of the Great Plains. "It's very peaceful here, and we just want to live simply," Solberg said last month as she pitched hay to her horses while meadowlarks sang in the distance. "That's exactly what we were looking for. But will we be able to live like this anymore?" Solberg and her family moved here in November from Idaho for her husband's job, bringing their menagerie. 12 chickens, 12 ducks, 2 horses, 3 cats, 4 dogs, including one 140-pound Anatolian shepherd who greets every visitor at the car door, and their milk cow, Lily. They sought solitude and freedom in Montana and found it outside Broadview, a town of about 140 people, with one restaurant, one gas station, and no stoplights along a lonely 2-lane highway that leads to Billings, the state's most populated city, 30 miles away. Then on January 4th, she saw a video on the town's Facebook page. A local activist whose daughter attends the town's only school was inviting people to meetings about AI data centers. "These AI centers are like something we've never seen before," the woman said on the video. Questions were racing through Solberg's head later that month as she sat among more than 100 people in an auditorium at Rocky Mountain College in Billings, where the local activist, Carrie Olson, and several environmental experts spoke about the recent wave of data center activity in Montana. At least 3 large data centers and many smaller ones have been proposed for the state, lured by tax breaks, vast open land, and Governor Greg Gianforte, who has tried to make Montana a hub for AI. So many people came to the meeting that some were stuck in the hallway trying to listen in. Solberg took notes. "A data center is a warehouse-sized building that holds a sea of computer servers that run day and night, collecting, processing, and storing data. Giant ones are needed to run AI models." The CEO of Quantica Infrastructure, developer of the Broadview project, has said on a podcast that the campus could have 12 to 16 buildings, 200,000 to 300,000 square feet each. Data centers need a lot of water, in some cases, more water than a small city needs, because the servers create intense heat and require continuous cooling. This could be disastrous for Broadview, Soberg thought, because water is precious here. Many residents struggle with low water flow. They don't do laundry and shower at the same time. She also learned that data centers require massive amounts of electricity. Northwestern Energy, Montana's largest power provider, signed a letter of intent to provide up to 1,000 megawatts to Quantica's Broadview data center, enough to power every home in the state on an average day, and then some. A few seats away from her were Charlie Baker, the CFO of Quantica, and Jess Peterson, a lobbyist and management consultant who is the local face of Big Sky Digital Infrastructure, the arm of Quantica that is developing the Broadview project. Soberg noticed the company's logo on one of their jackets. The two men listened to the presentation, but never spoke. A Broadview Town Council member's garage was renovated recently. Now it's the local headquarters for Big Sky Digital Infrastructure, which holds weekly office hours to give the community a chance to talk to the company about the data center. Peterson said Quantica had gone out of its way to have a complete transparency about its project, which would be a data center done right. He acknowledged that some residents might be concerned about what they had learned from environmental groups about potential water and electricity usage, but the public just has to trust that Quantica will do right by them, he said. They are partners in this. Everyone will know more, he told me, when Quantica signs a contract with the tech company to use the facility. Besides, Peterson said, much of the apprehension over the data center comes from people who are afraid of AI more broadly, as if Big Brother is going to take over, he said. Those people, he added, have no role in this conversation. What Peterson could tell me now, he said, was that the project would have minimal impact on the land and the people who live nearby. He offered no guarantees, but said the project would bring its own power, at least some of it, from solar and natural gas. Despite what opponents have been saying, and despite information gleaned from data centers around the world, Peterson said the Broadview site would need not that terribly much water. It will bring jobs, he said. Thousands of temporary workers could descend on Broadview for the construction. The number of permanent jobs would be 30, 40, 100. He doesn't know for sure. But he described them as good-paying jobs that would not require specialized training or a college education. Jobs like janitors, maintenance workers, or security guards. He likened it to being a miner but not having to grab a drill. Generations of families could stay in Broadview because people would not have to move to make a living, as many are doing now. They could say, oh my gosh, I could push a broom and come home to my house in Lavina that I love, and my kids can do that. For anyone who doesn't like the idea of living next to a data center, he added, there's probably a county up the road that doesn't have one. In Wrangler jeans and a hoodie under a jean jacket, Soberg stood in front of the Yellowstone County Commissioners at one of their weekly meetings in March, voice shaky and notes in hand, as she presented a case to pause the development of the data center. We would like some guardrails on this project out in Broadview, she said, asking for the county to pass an interim zoning ordinance so it could have time to study the project's impact. We'd like transparency, accountability, and protections. As Soberg read her exhaustive research about the effects of data centers on things like water, air temperature, and electricity, the commissioners grew antsy. How much longer, one said. The county denied Solberg's request. Every day, Soberg sits at her desk that looks out onto miles of prairie and reads about people across the country who have succeeded in hindering data centers. They're storming into town hall meetings, recalling politicians who don't endorse moratoriums, lobbying for state legislation. She has been desperately trying to get that kind of traction in Broadview. There have been no breakthroughs yet. I hope I will be able to make a difference, she said, but you know, I'm just not sure. The Montana legislature meets only once every 2 years, and it is not set to convene again until January. The data center construction may be well on its way before state lawmakers offer help, she says. Her fellow Broadview area residents aren't exactly galvanizing behind her efforts. Residents who meet most mornings at the Homestead Inn, the only restaurant for miles, say they don't know what all the fuss is about. Yet Solberg continues to show up at every town council and county commissioner's meeting. She has some allies. Rick Eaton, a knife maker who raises horses, was one of more than a dozen people at the hearing in favor of Solberg's zoning request. She has been carrying a heavy load, especially being right there near where the data center will be, he said later. 20 years ago, Eaton and his wife, Marie, moved to an 1,100-acre ranch northeast of Broadview from the West Coast. His main worries are that the data center will cause his wells to go dry and make his electric bills unaffordable. Tim Wipf is the president of the Mountain View Huttery Colony outside the town, where his group of German-speaking Anabaptists lives on a communal farm. They have 160 dairy cows and 19,000 chickens. They sell eggs to Walmart, and they ship 1,800 pigs a week to other states. The farm needs a lot of clean water. These people do think we are stupid, he said. But where do people think their eggs and milk come from? People like us. The Yellowstone County Commissioners suggested that Solberg pursue a special zoning ordinance that citizens can initiate to protect the health, safety, and welfare of county residents. She wondered out loud if they were sending her on a wild goose chase. The citizen-led zoning permit requires approval from at least 60% of the landowners whose properties border the data center, and Solberg and her husband have been trying to get those ranchers and farmers to sign petitions in support of it. But that has been a challenge. This time of year, ranchers are busy branding and castrating their calves. A few have declined because they've leased their land to Quantica. Solberg invites the landowners, 20 of them, to a weekly video call to discuss the zoning regulations she must formulate to create a special district. Only one family has shown up. With just days left to file the paperwork with the county, she drove 6 hours round trip to save an hours-old calf whose mother was sent to slaughter. She then stayed up past midnight and tried to draft the regulations, a daunting assignment for someone with no legal background. She has felt growing pressure. Last week, Quantica announced a new plan to generate not just 1,100 megawatts of power for the Broadview campus, but more than 7,000 megawatts. That's more power than is generated by Grand Coulee Dam, the largest power plant in the country. If Quantica uses all that power in Broadview, the site would be one of the biggest data center campuses in the world. There's a monster coming, Solberg said. I'm just trying to warn everyone about it. And with just a few minutes left, we'll pop over on the Talking Points page and read the short notes and such. The Pentagon has cut 180 different religious traditions and belief systems, including atheism, Unitarian Universalism, and paganism, from its list of recognized faith groups. Of the 31 remaining faith groups service members can have listed on their personal records, 22 are Christian denominations. Numerous GOP-led states are rebranding June, widely observed as LGBTQ Pride Month, as a celebration of traditional families. Indiana and Tennessee have designated June as Nuclear Family Month to honor households made up of one husband, one wife, and any biological, adopted, or fostered children. Alabama as Strong Families Month, and Utah and Arkansas as Fidelity Month. Opportunistic property crimes such as auto thefts have dropped 24% in Washington, D.C. since President Trump deployed the National Guard to the city, according to the nonpartisan Niskanen Center. The 2,800 troops stationed there at a cost of $1.5 million a day have had no measurable impact on violent crimes. Of the nearly 1,600 January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol rioters granted clemency by President Trump, nearly 1 in 16 have since been arrested for, charged with, or convicted of new crimes. Those offenses include possession of drug paraphernalia, child molestation, homicide, and plotting to assassinate government officials. On the poll watch, 65% of Americans support same-sex marriage, down from a peak of 71% in 2023. The drop mostly comes among Republicans, whose support of same-sex marriage has plummeted from 55% in 2022 to 37%. And we'll finish the show with a couple of quotes. Benjamin Franklin says, "Whoever would overthrow the liberty of a nation must begin by subduing the freedom of speech." And Phil Larkin very succinctly says, "What will survive of us is love." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.